Thank you. So we'll start by reading verses 1 through 10. Shane, you got that ready? Yeah, 7. Chapter 7, 1 through 10.
Verse 1 through 10?
Right.
After these things, Jesus walked in Galilee. For he did not want to walk in Judea, because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of tabernacles was at hand. His brother therefore said to him, depart from here and go into Judea, that your disciples also may see the work that you are doing. For no one does anything in secret while he himself seeks to be known. If you do not do these things, show yourself to the world. For even his brothers did not believe in him. Jesus said to him, my time is not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate me, but it hates me, because I testify of it at his works, that his works are evil. He went to this feast, and am not yet going up to this feast, for my time is not yet fully come. When he had said these things to them, he remained in Galilee.
Verse 10, right.
But when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast, not openly, but at his word, to see.
Okay, thanks. Okay, so as we said, Jesus is still in Galilee at the moment, probably towards the end of his Galilean ministry. All the things we've been talking about for the last several weeks, the miracles and his teachings, Peter's great confession of faith, having already happened. So in verse 1 there, it's talking about he was staying in Galilee because he was afraid of the Jews in Judea. And I think both of us would probably agree he was afraid of the high Jewish authorities that were in Judea, possibly just Judeans in general, but I think it was probably the Pharisees and the like that were in and around the vicinity of Jerusalem. And certainly when we get to verse 13, when the term is used there, there's no doubt who it refers to. It is those high authorities. So why were they seeking to kill him? I think his popularity was becoming a threat to them, dangerous to their political standing, which they tended to like a lot. They liked being Pharisees. Any other thoughts on that? So verse 2 talks about the Feast of the Booths, and I think the first question was, what is the Feast of the Booths? As in Shane's version, whatever he was reading there, it called it the Feast of the Tabernacles, which is another word for the same feast. And so it was a 7-day harvest feast in the time of year we'd call October. I think it was like the 9th Jewish month, and I don't remember the name of it. It was a feast or observance that was established in Leviticus, I think chapter 23. This whole chapter and chapter 8 following are all basically take place during this 7-day period of time of the Feast of the Booths. And so during this time, Jews from all over, even the heathen lands around, would come in and celebrate. And the reason it was called booths or tabernacles was because that's what they would build to live in for these 7 days. And obviously with all these people coming into Jerusalem, probably wasn't enough room to sit, stay in people's houses and the hotels or whatever they had there. So that was one reason for building these booths, is it gave them a place to camp out for the week. So they were pilgrims. And it was a pretty colorful affair. It was pretty a joyous thing. It was the harvest, after all. One of the harvests, and it had a couple of interesting ceremonies that were part of it. One involving the pouring out of water, which we'll get to later in the text tonight, and the lighting of great lights in the temple. And both of those things happened on the last day of the feast. And we'll talk a little bit more about those when we get late in the chapter. Anyone have anything else they want to say about this? Good point. That's a very important point, actually. If you didn't hear, Tony said the primary reason they were making these booths or tabernacles is to remind them of how they were in the Exodus, living there. Anyone else? Tom? Right. And I think some of the reading I did indicate they didn't, all these people obviously bringing it with you would be burdensome, especially if you didn't have a beast of some sort to carry it on. So a lot of them would make them out of stuff that they could find in the area, palm fronds and things like that. So in verse 5 there, it says that for not even his brothers were believing in him. It's probably his biological brothers. I'm not sure that's necessarily what it was, but I think it was probably his biological brothers. And his brothers had seen, obviously been present for some of these miracles and great things that he was doing. They may have been among the disciples who had withdrawn from Jesus in verse 66 of the previous chapter of John. After Jesus had talked about, you must eat of my flesh and drink of my blood. And you remember how that turned a lot of them away at that point. That may have been too much for his brothers as well. So in verse 6, Jesus responds to what they've said. Which was, hey Jesus, you should just go to Jerusalem, go ahead and get to that capital city and show yourself. And they said this even though they didn't believe in him, but Jesus responded and said, no, my time is not yet here, but your time is always opportune. So one of my questions was, what did he mean by that? What did Jesus mean by saying your time is always opportune? And kind of, before I studied it, I thought, well, maybe it meant, your time's always opportune to start believing in me. But the more I looked at it, I'm not sure that was the correct thing to draw. I think conclusion to draw. I think it's a reference to the fact that to them, to the brothers, from their kind of worldly, fleshly viewpoint, it was always a good time for Jesus to unveil himself and make himself known. They said, hey, let's, they're according to their idea of the timing, hey, right now would be a great time for you to just go to Jerusalem and right into the capital city, tell them you're the Messiah. So even though they didn't believe in who he was, they were still prodding him to do this. Perhaps they knew it would be a good show when that happened. It was obviously going to be a very interesting time when he did decide to do that, and they may just wanted to move away from the little league stuff in Galilee and get right into the heart of Judea and do the same thing. And maybe they were thinking, hey, maybe I'll come along and I'll believe if I see a little bit more. So that's a little bit of supposition there. Anyone have any other ideas for how we would answer that question? What was meant by, but your time is always opportune? Great.
Yep.
For them,
yeah,
themselves.
Got it.
Right. You know, sometimes a simple explanation is the best. I believe.
And you kind of see this. If it was your brother who you know has come from very humble means and everything, although he'd get this attention out. And doing all these things here. And just go, and it's hard, it can be hard from a human standpoint to recognize, but just go, but first of all, this is my brother, not anything else. So I see this as them being jealous and being sarcastic. I said, well, if you want to go and get all this attention, you need to go and do it. Type thing. And just totally disregarding what his mission is or refusing to accept who he truly is.
Right.
And based on that, it's like he's bad in this contrast with him of, you know, you can do anything you want. Your time's always at, other words say, your time's always ready.
Right.
You're free to go do what you want. I've got a mission, and time is not yet coming.
You know, not right.
Down there and do what you're kind of trying to block me to do.
Yep. Right. Along the lines of what Greg just said, that was close. okay, anyone else? All right. So in verses 8 through 10, looks like Jesus evidently, you know, he didn't want to arrive earlier with any announcement. In fact, I think in verse 14 it indicates that he may not have even arrived until sometime in the middle of the feast, after everybody's attention was kind of diverted or towards with the activities of that week. So let's read 11 through 18. Patrick, would you mind doing that? Yes, please.
Then the Jews saw him at the feast, and said, "Where is he?" And there was much murmuring among the people concerning him. For some said, "He is a good man." Others said, "Nay, but he deceived the people. Howbeit, no man spake openly of him for fear of the Jews." Now about the midst of the feast, Jesus went up to the temple, and the Jews marveled, saying, "How knoweth this man the letters, having never learned?" Jesus answered them and said, "My doctrine is not mine, but is that sin. But his that sent me. If any man will do his will, he will know of doctrine, whether it be of God, or whether I speak of myself. He that speaketh of himself seeketh his own glory, but he that seeketh the glory that sent him, the same is true, and no unrighteousness is in him."
Okay, so in verses 11 through 13, the people were expecting him to arrive for this feast. Obviously, the stories of what had been going on up in Galilee were known in Jerusalem, and people were really expecting him to make his move into Judea and come to this feast. But the talk was hushed because people didn't want to upset the leadership in town, so they were kind of whispering among themselves, wondering where he was. In verse 14, it says that Jesus, in the midst of the feast, Jesus went to the temple and began to teach. We don't know what he taught. It's not said here, or I don't believe anywhere else in the Gospels. But it does mention the reaction of the crowd. They know that Jesus has not been formally educated, but it was very obvious that he was, in fact, highly educated by someone, somewhere, somehow. And then Jesus explained that it's not his teaching that he's giving, but the teaching of God. Any other points anyone would like to bring up about this section? Mark.
In the verse 4, it said that he's accused by his brothers of not really seeking notoriety here. And you have brought the opposite of that. When he's evidently murdered that, well, the people marveling about his knowledge, wisdom, he vividly said,
Yeah. Good point. Tony?
I think there's possibly a very subtle lesson for us in verse 15. Because if we were looking at the context, it's almost like talking about everybody there. It's literally two people, or two groups of people, the Jews and the multitude. Where the Jews in this case, if you're looking at the context, would be the Jewish leaders.
Right.
The multitude of the people who are talking. So, if that assumption is correct, as far as the context, then verse 15 when it's talking about the Jews were marveling and asking, yeah, how does this man become one who's never been educated? But that's the leaders. And that maybe gives an insight into at least part of the reason why they just didn't get past some things within the cause of where they put value.
Right.
And it's like, well, this guy wasn't educated like us.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Therefore, he couldn't really know what's in the law like we do.
Right.
Or anything here. So they, you know, would be, at least part, it's not the whole reason why they weren't accepting, don't get me wrong. But,
right.
And I think there's a lesson there for us, because we very easy for us to do the same thing. If we don't see people as being well educated or well spoken, whatever the case may be, well, they really don't know what they're doing here. I don't know if they really listen to what they're saying.
Right.
That's not uncommon for us.
Right. Or maybe they won't ever understand what I'm teaching them, which the simple lessons and the essential lessons of the gospel are easily understood, and anybody can get them, I think. All right. We'll move on to verses 19 through 24. James, would you read those for us? Okay, so thank you. So to understand this section, it's probably helpful to understand the context of what Jesus was referring to when he said, I did one work. And I think you find that context back in chapter 5. You don't have to turn to it, but it is the account of the healing at the Pool of Bethesda, which was in Jerusalem. So in chapter 5, it's in Jerusalem. Chapter 6, you're back in Galilee. In 7, I'm not sure John necessarily is written in chronological order. I'm sure someone here knows better than me whether this was two separate trips to Jerusalem or one. I think it's probably one, but anyway, he had in Jerusalem at this pool. If you'll recall, he had there had been a man, a lame man, sitting by this pool that would get stirred up occasionally at certain times, and like the first one in the pool, when that happened, would be healed. So he was at that pool, and he saw this lame man who complained that no one would ever help him get in. So he'd been coming there for years and not being successful. So and this was the Sabbath day, and Jesus healed the man, and you recall he said, get up, take up your pallet, and walk, right? And so the Jews first accused the lame man for carrying his pallet on the Sabbath as being unauthorized work. And then, of course, turned right to Jews and accused him of the same thing for doing this dastardly deed on the Sabbath. So that's what he's referring to, as best I can tell, in this section that James just read for us. So he brings this up as he continues to, you know, accuse the Jewish leaders of hypocrisy and misunderstanding the law of Moses or applying traditions that contradict it, and he counsels them to not judge according to appearance, but to judge with righteous judgment, or to judge rightly. There is a similar statement of Christ in the next chapter in verses 15 and 16. So Moses, as a messenger of God, gave the law from God about refraining from doing work on the Sabbath day. All right. And he also gave the law about circumcision, and both were involved in this example that Jesus is going to give or gave here. And so he says they follow the law about the circumcision, but they don't consider it breaking the law about the Sabbath. And there's no doubt that circumcision is a form of work. I don't think no one would argue about that. But anyway, the rabbis kind of developed their own rule for these situations, which really isn't all that bad. He said if there's a positive commandment, which means, in other words, do this, a command that says do this, it trumps a command that is a negative command, or don't do this. So if there's a positive command that contradicts a negative command, the positive command is what you would do. Which, as I said, is not necessarily a bad guide. But the problem is in all their rulemaking and tradition establishment, they allowed a negative law, don't work on the Sabbath, to trump a different positive law, a very important positive law. What was that? Anybody know? Jesus said what the most important law was. Two laws that were similar. Exactly. Jesus said those were the two most important laws. Fear God with all your mind, soul, heart, and strength. And like second and like unto it, love your neighbor as thyself. Right? The Pharisees had completely, I guess, didn't think about that law, that positive law, and instead allowed a negative law about not working on the Sabbath to trump it. In this case, and many, many others, right? They made a lot of rules that kind of violated that principle, I think. You recall, for instance, Jesus accused the Pharisees earlier of, you say you can't help your parents because you've given all that you have to God, to the Lord. That would, I think, be an example of this as well. Another point Christ made in Luke 14 and 5, he said, which one of you will have a son or an ox fall into a well and will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? So Jesus has talked about this. What to kind of help define what work is forbidden on the Sabbath and what work is perfectly fine on the Sabbath. That's right. Absolutely. Bill?
The other thing, this chapter, the entire context, people say, is this Christ made who Jesus is? And part of Jesus revealing himself in this is reminding them of that event in John 5. They will point out that in John 5, his response to the Pharisees' rebuke is, my Father is working to this day, and I am working. God worked on the Sabbath. Only men were working on the Sabbath. God continued to sustain his creation. He continued to work on the Sabbath. And Jesus' point God by this, I am working because I am God like my Father. And he's reminding the Pharisees. Jesus is rebuking the Pharisees as he did in the Sermon on the Mount, their exaltation, their teaching over the cross of all.
Right.
But he's really reminding them here, he's trying to reveal just who he is. Brothers, I want you to reveal yourself. Well, it's not my time, but now he's starting to do just that.
Right.
And part of what he's revealing here is he works on the Sabbath because he is the one who gave him
the Sabbath. Right.
He works on the Sabbath. He said, "Hearts."
Thank you. Very good. Yeah, and of course, I guess we'd say the book of John is all about confirming who that Jesus is the Christ, is the Messiah. I think is the main theme of the overall book. So, back to the original question. You know, what did he mean by what does it mean to judge rightly? I think Jesus is saying, you know, think about the law, understand God's intent, understand who God is, consider all these things, and then make your judgment about what's right and wrong.
When I look at the context of things saying, what comes across to me is just put the comparison out here. And he doesn't condemn them in really what on how they're handling circumcision on the Sabbath day. It's more like,
right,
you did this and you don't have a problem with it.
That's right.
And he's not saying you should or anything, but if you don't have a problem with it, it's kind of implied that you shouldn't.
Yep.
Then why do you have a problem with me doing good and carrying out things that are helpful and loving,
right,
for the people? And so he should put that contrast up there, and for those who are listening, hopefully that would get their attention, make them take a step back. Well, he's got that point here. And I think that when he's getting to, okay, so don't worry about your parents, it's to judge righteously, and your righteous judgment is along the line of faith. Don't set a double standard out there. Don't set a standard for yourself and apply it, and then try to apply a different standard. Have righteous judgment. Be fair across the board. And apply the law equally and righteously.
Yep. Good. Yeah, and I think in doing this, Jesus he's illuminating the I think the New Testament idea that Paul is going to later state in 2 Corinthians 3. You know, he says the letter killeth, but the Spirit gives life. And in Galatians 5, starting in verse 22, he says the fruit of the Spirit is love, gentleness, meekness, some other things. And against such there is no law. There is no law against good. And there never was, even in Old Testament times. So that part of it was not new. So is there application for us today? That absolutely, and yeah, we could apply that to our thinking. So we won't read it, but in verses 25 through 32, you see that due to Jesus' speech, some in the crowd wondered aloud why Jesus is being allowed to speak this way for so long in this place, right in the temple, with all the Jewish leadership around. Some were even wondering if some of the leaders had begun to accept that he was the Christ, so therefore they were not apt to have him arrested or persecute him or speak against him. Now that was not largely the case, because the reason was it was not yet Jesus' time to be arrested. It was getting close, but it wasn't quite time. The leadership did send officers to seize him in verse 32, but as we'll find out, the officers didn't actually do that. They didn't do what they were sent to do. In verses 32 through 36, Jesus baffles the Jewish leaders when he says he's going somewhere that they can't follow. And some say that they wonder if he means if he's going to the dispersion among the Greeks, and that's a reference, I think, to the Jews that live in other parts, not in Israel, but other parts of the Roman Empire, with the Greeks, and the dispersion being, hey, they're scattered around, they're in the heathen lands. And then verse 37 through 39, it says, "Now on the last day, the great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried out, saying, 'If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scripture said, from his innermost being will flow rivers of living water.' But this he spoke of the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive. For the Spirit was not yet given, because Jesus was not yet glorified." So on this last day of the feast, known as the Great Day, in the morning, going back to what I said earlier on, in the morning there was a ceremony that was referred to as the pouring of the water at the pool of Siloam. I'm not sure I'm saying that right. One of the pools there in the area of the temple. A Jewish historian that I was reading said the symbolic meaning of the ceremony, it was indeed an outpouring of God's Spirit. That's what it was kind of designed to show. So if you can imagine, it's not necessarily the case that this happened, but you can imagine that somewhere during this ceremony or right at the end of it, where they had poured the water and the people had done their incantations and the stuff that they would do as part of this ceremony, that's when Jesus may have cried out and said what he did here. And of course, what he said was what I just read. So one thing that's kind of interesting here, but you know, we'll come back to that at the end. That was the bonus question. We may not get to it. But so if this is indeed when, you know, when Jesus said what he did, the source I was reading also said, you know, Jesus was, in his opinion, Jesus wasn't interrupting the ceremony. He was interpreting the ceremony and kind of showing the fulfillment of what they were doing. And I think that's kind of interesting to think about, that may have been exactly how it unfolded then. Any comments on that part? Okay. Verses 40 through 43 kind of highlights the diversity of opinion in the crowd. Some seem to be either ignorant of the place of Jesus' birth and his Davidic lineage, or perhaps some of them knew and they were just diverting attention from it because they were against Jesus' claim as to who he was. But anyway, there were certainly a mix of believers and disbelievers in there, and disparagers. So we'll read 45 through 52 now. Greg, would you mind reading that for us?
"The officers then came to the chief priests and Pharisees and said to them, 'Why did you not believe?' The officers answered, 'Never has a man spoken the way this man speaks.' The Pharisees then answered them, 'You have not also been led astray. No one of the rulers or Pharisees this crowd which did not know the law is accursed. Nicodemus, he who came to him before, being one of them, said to them, 'Our law does not judge a man unless he first hears from him and knows what he is doing, does it?' They answered him, 'You are not also from Galilee, are you? Search and see that no prophet arises out of Galilee.'"
Okay, so thank you. As in verses 45 and 46, the statement that the officers made, "Never has a man spoken as this man speaks." Probably both the believers and the naysayers would have agreed with what they were hearing, I think. That was certainly Jesus spoke in a manner that was unique, as one with authority, as we know someone had said while he was up in Galilee still. Meaning he wasn't just a student of the law, but he was a lawgiver, and he knew it thoroughly from the Father. And it must have been, you know, to an extreme here, because, you know, this setting, it seems like it would have given him a great opportunity to actually arrest Jesus at this point. He was easily accessible in the temple. The officers were right there. Something was preventing them from doing this right then and there. But the officers also surely knew they'd face a lot of heat from the people who had sent them for coming back empty-handed. So that just speaks even more to how awestruck they were here. So one of the questions was, what did the officers mean by their statement? I may have given a partial answer, but does anyone want to elaborate a little bit on that? Never has a man spoken the way this man speaks. Devin, did you raise your hand?
He passed right after the Sermon on the Mount. It says he spoke with one hand in glory, and not as the scribes and Pharisees. So this was directly from the source. This wasn't a conversation about what the law meant. This was the law giver.
Right. And it was evident that he was very different than the others that taught. Tony?
Yeah. One of the things is that it's not like the men that the leaders had sent were hearing something different than what the leaders themselves had heard. They both heard the same message, but the difference is the heart in which that message fell. And these men, when they heard what he was saying before, I was talking about Tony, if he had the right heart, might force him to take a step back. That's what you're seeing here,
right?
Anyway, is that they're going and they've been told to arrest him, but they're listening to him and their heart is such that they're touched by what they're hearing. And it's important to take a step back and go, okay, what exactly is he doing so wrong we can bring him in? He actually knows what the law is saying. And when you go on down here and, you know, the Pharisees and the leaders are like, well, you know, he's uneducated and these people are, first of all, they're uneducated, so he's fooling them. Like, no. He's demonstrating his knowledge of the law. He's communicating in a way that we've never heard before, that we're now understanding what the law is supposed to be about. And, you know, it's really an affront to the leaders, because they should have been able to do that to some degree if they really studied and put so much stock in their education, but putting stock in what the Word says and trying to communicate that to the people and
Yeah, there were some holes in the curriculum at these prestigious schools that they had attended, apparently. Or, good. What else? Okay. So 47 and 49 records some sneers that the leaders answered the officers with when they came back with this statement that never has a man spoken as this man speaks. He said, they asked them, you've not also been led astray, have you? Obviously, assuming that anyone who listens to Christ has been being led astray. And they said, but this crowd which does not know the law is accursed. And it displays the arrogance of this Jewish hierarchy towards the people that they were leading. You know, they're ignorant and they're easily led astray by, you know, any Yahoo who comes along and claims to be somebody. So, and then in 50 and 52, she did read all the way through there. I was trying to check. So there's this man named Nicodemus, who we know is on the Sanhedrin, very prestigious body council. How would you characterize his belief in Christ at this point, given what we read about here? Is he a believer? Is he not a believer? What else might we assume, or can we assume, about his faith at this point in Christ? He's getting there. I think you're right. Yeah. Mark? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's obviously come
Yeah. Yep. I think that's right. Mark? Right. Yep. Right. So what do you say? He's defending Christ by pointing out, hey, our rules say we kind of got to do this. Right. Yeah. Yeah, I think he is defending Christ, although he's doing it indirectly. He doesn't seem like he's quite ready to, you know, go to the other side. But he, in a way, he's pointing out, hey, we got some rules here we need to follow. And leanings. Right. Right. Yeah. And he, undoubtedly, he enjoyed his lifestyle too. And although I think he was, as Andrew said, he was coming along, and he may even believe, but that's a big leap to finally make this, you know, flip the switch and make the commitment, because he was going to lose his life as he knew it. Which, by the way, is what Jesus says followers of him must do, right? Give up your life to have life in him. Be willing to give it up. And I'm sure he was scared of being ostracized and cast out. And his commitment may not have quite been fully mature at this point. Didn't appear. So, Tom. That's true.
Clearly, they're insecure in what they do. They're insecure in their own positions, because Jesus is pointing out things that don't square. And other people are probably pointing out things that don't square. But some of them certainly must have seen the truth. Some of them must have.
Yep.
And so leaders are being threatened. This is the way, this is not the way that we talk. We don't want to act like we are insecure, threatened, defensive, because that's a way of saying the faith is what it ought to be. You're not.
Right. Thank you. Ron, one more comment?
I was just going to say, it seems to me like he's doing a little bit of work. He's just going to write out, make it strong for the same.
Yep. Yes.
But he's got to have a lose what he's going to do. He's got a lot of baggage.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to kind of sift his way through that baggage. But the heart is such that he does end up getting there.
Right.
We're seeing him kind of midway through that journey now.
Yep.
But to me, that's talking about a 3-year journey or so for him, because when you get to the end of John, you see where he's at after the death of Christ.
Right.
And this is a man who is working his way through it.
Yep. Good point.
If they can have a right heart, they will get there. So let's just keep working with them and helping them get there.
sharing his word with them and helping them understand that we'll work the way through it.
Good. Thank you. Time is up. I've thoroughly enjoyed studying with you. I appreciate it. I always learn way more than anyone else in the room, I'm sure. But thank you for your participation and thoughts.